Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why? And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 112, Getting Closer. Here at Cheap Astronomy, we like to imagine a future where we're talking to aliens, as well as scooting around the solar system, mining asteroids, and building space colonies. But is any of this getting any closer to reality? Well, Dear Cheap Astronomy, how will we find the first evidence of extraterrestrial life? Well, of course, we don't know. The question is more an invitation to review the various options and rank the relative likelihood of those options based on the information we have to hand. So, it's possible that we may find evidence of intelligent life in the form of an electromagnetic signal of technological origin coming from another star system. However, signal attenuation over light year distances means it's not likely that our current technology could detect signs of Earth civilization from more than about 5 light years away, and there aren't that many star systems within a 5 light-year radius of ours. It's also been our experience on Earth that as technology advances, we become more radio quiet, favoring cable and fiber optics instead of open-air broadcasting. Indeed, a civilization that developed underground wouldn't find much use for electromagnetic transmissions at all, at least not until they started space exploration. In any case, we've detected nothing to date and may well continue detecting nothing for a long time to come. But the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Fermi's paradox is based on some naive assumptions. Another option is that we'll find evidence of fossilized life on a meteor that's come from somewhere else in the solar system. Kind of like the 1996 claim of fossilized life found on ALH-A4001, a meteorite from Mars with microscopic structures allegedly resembling bacteria, although that's a claim that's never really gained wide acceptance. Nonetheless, finding such fossils is possible. Indeed, one day we might even find fossils on an extrasolar object that's in transit through our system. However, while all this is possible, it is a low probability option. After all, Earth must be a rich source of space transiting rocks that have been thrown up by meteor impacts. But those rocks would be an exceedingly tiny proportion of all the rocks that are to be found floating around the solar system, let alone outside it. So just on that basis, we should assume that you are vastly more likely to find a space rock with no evidence of life than a space rock with evidence. Of course, we do have other options for finding life in the solar system. For example, we've now had several rovers exploring the surface of Mars. These are yet to find any evidence of either fossilized or living life, but it's certainly worth pursuing further surface exploration as well as doing sample returns. Given the extent of the search so far, no one's expecting we'll find more than microbial-scale life, but that would still be quite something. The other major search frontiers in the solar system include the oceans of gas giant moons, notably Europa and Enceladus, which have confirmed liquid water oceans beneath an icy crust. After that, there's Venus's cloud tops, which do have life-friendly temperature and pressure zones, although there's no water. The recent discovery of phosphine in Venus's atmosphere represents little more than weak circumstantial evidence where life might be one explanation for its presence, notwithstanding there's still much debate about whether or how much phosphine we've really detected there. Anyhow, to date, we've taken an appropriately probability-based approach to searching for extraterrestrial life. SETI, the Astronomical Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, kicked off in the early 1960s and is still going strong. And as soon as we could get to Mars, we started looking there for life, and that's still going strong. The next best options of the gas giant moons and Venus's cloud tops have already been investigated with spacecraft missions, and there are plans to go back for a closer look in the next decade or two. Indeed, anywhere we go in space, we do always keep an eye out just in case. Of course, with life on Earth being the only life we know of, we have a natural bias to look for the same kind of life elsewhere. Genuinely alien life may be of a form that we haven't considered yet, and hence we could be looking in the wrong places. Nonetheless, alien life should share some common principles of chemistry and structure, at least to the extent of supporting growth and reproduction, and also evolution, which may be a mandatory factor if life forms are to become capable of making and wielding technology.
This is the middle bit.
This is the nature of scientific exploration. Our exploration of Mars to date has ruled out any likelihood of finding green humanoids with antennae. The search has now been narrowed down to microbial life. Indeed, it may be we only find long dead and fossilized microbial life, which will still be something. But can we be confident the human race is going to persist long enough to make such earth-shattering discoveries? For example,
Dear Cheap Astronomy, are we safe from asteroids now? Well, no, but we're safer. The recent DART mission showed that you can divert the trajectory of an asteroid by hitting it with a fast-moving spacecraft. The 500-kilogram DART's kamikaze crash moved the asteroid Dimorphos by some tens of meters. Tens of meters won't save the Earth from a collision with an object that's already closing in, but from a sufficient distance, such a tiny shift could well be enough to modify the object's trajectory so it does miss the Earth. Of course, you'd then have to recalculate the parameters of its new trajectory and hope it won't just come back around again, which is exceedingly unlikely, but we know from Earth's history that very unlikely and very bad things do sometimes happen. Right now, we know there are over 29,000 near-Earth asteroids and over 100 near-Earth comets, and of those near-Earth objects, 2,270 are considered potentially hazardous objects because they cross the Earth's orbit and have a diameter of more than 140 meters. About 150 of those 2,000 plus potentially hazardous objects are over 1 kilometer in diameter, which puts them in the global catastrophe range. Any over 5 kilometers in diameter are in the mass extinction range, but there's only two of those we know of, neither of which are on anything like a collision course with Earth. You may also hear that just in the last year or so, we have now positively identified 97% of all near-Earth asteroids over 1 kilometer in diameter, not all of which are on potentially hazardous Earth orbit crossing trajectories, they're just in the general vicinity. This knowledge arises from the Space Guard Initiative, where back in the 1990s, NASA was set the goal of identifying over 90% of near-Earth objects greater than a kilometre in diameter. That goal was achieved in around 10 years, and since then the name Space Guard has become a more generalised term to cover any similar efforts both in and outside of NASA. The current coverage of 97% means we've identified 891 of an estimated 920 near-Earth objects. Of course, that all means that we think there are still 29 objects yet to be identified. And since we're just guessing the total is 920, there might be another 30 or 31 yet to be identified. The total estimate of 920 objects is based on some mathematical modelling that's extrapolated out from the known population of objects, and it's probably about right, but there is still a scary unlikelihood that there might be one or two long period near-Earth objects with highly elliptical orbits that just shoot in for a brief perihelion around the Sun and are then not seen again for hundreds or even thousands of years. If these unlikely and unknown objects exist, they would be icy objects originating from outside the asteroid belt, and hence probably would be comets that develop a tail of volatiles blown out by the solar wind as they approach the Sun. Most of the near-Earth objects we know about originate from within the asteroid belt, and so are more rocky, have less eccentric orbits, and have had all their volatiles baked off long ago. Probability-wise, we are much more likely to get hit by an asteroid in a nearby orbit, since there's so many more of them with so many more potentially Earth-intersecting trajectories. We think the mass extinction-producing 10-kilometer diameter Chicxulub object that hit the Earth 66 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs was such a rocky asteroid based on the fact it had a high iridium content. But whatever the likelihood or unlikelihood of a near-Earth object collision, constant vigilance is always the best policy. Since the possibility of a previously unknown object appearing out of nowhere is not zero, and with our current technologies, we'd still need at least 10 years advance warning to manage a dart-like asteroid deflection, it's important we keep measuring the current and future trajectories of all the big near-Earth objects out there and keep on tracking them pretty much indefinitely. So, we could still all die tomorrow, or more likely die within months of seeing something tomorrow that's coming right for us and is already too close or too fast to do anything about. But at least now we know for a fact that is a very unlikely scenario, and we do have most of the more likely scenarios covered now. So, we could be okay as long as we keep at it.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. Science is getting closer to saving the world, having at least established there's no obvious immediate threats that are coming our way. There's still a faint chance of something unexpected sneaking up upon us, but more likely that will be a sub-kilometre city-killer asteroid rather than a 10-plus-kilometre mass extinction object like the one that killed the dinosaurs, apart from the birds. However, in the longer term, the likelihood of a mass extinction object coming our way does start growing, and indeed may be close to statistically inevitable at some point in the next 100 million years or so. Over that time frame, you'd think we'll surely have developed the ability to deflect such a threat, all assuming we don't wipe ourselves out beforehand. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you want to wipe any doubt off the face of the Earth, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll change the whole landscape for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.